All right, welcome to another episode of Out from the Cube. I am your host, George Evian, as joined always with Mr. Joe Quinn. Joe, good afternoon. How are you, sir?
I'm excellent, George. Good afternoon to you as well.
You have lined up another outstanding guest for us. You are batting 1,000 and I appreciate lining up this guest today. We have with us Ellen Moran. I'm very excited about this, who runs an executive team coaching company here in the St. Louis area called Leadership Dialogues, and very excited about actually talking offline before we hit record. Ellen just started going and going, and I was like, this is all the stuff we want to talk about. We're going to have you repeat it. Like, it was all, I went and grabbed my notebook really quick. Joe was leaning over, writing some notes down, and we were like, hey, that's awesome. That's gold. We have to make sure that you bring that back up. So we're going to have you, Ellen, repeat some of the things that you were mentioning offline before we hit record. But welcome to our podcast. Welcome to our show. We appreciate you making time for us.
Well, it's a real pleasure to be here. I'm excited to chat about things.
Yes, and looking over your website, definitely the guests that we have on are typically, you know, team development, team coaches, leadership coaches, and things of that nature. So your website, what you do, tell us real quick what Leadership Dialogues is and what you do here in the St. Louis area, if not in the Midwest.
Sure. The name Leadership Dialogues comes from the fact that everything leaders do is through dialogue. Right. And having the right kinds of dialogues about things is what really moves an organization or people forward. Mm. And so sometimes I will give assessments, and that becomes a dialogue about who you are, what your strengths are, what your challenges are, and what can move you ahead. The same thing with coaching, whether you're coaching as a manager or, in my case, coaching leaders. Again, it's through dialogue and understanding that we really begin to create change. And so I do that as well, coaching and a great deal of assessment, sometimes to select the right person for the job. Sometimes it's to develop them. And I do both of those. And then a third thing I do that I have been involved with, gosh, for 20 years now, is something called the language and behavior profile. And what that means is that people reveal in the language they use how they're thinking, how they're motivated, and how they're likely to behave. Hmm. And they do that through just answering some open-ended questions. And we can tell by the structure of the way they answer it how they're motivated. So I'll give you a quick example.
Yeah, absolutely.
If I say to you, George, what's important to you about running podcasts? What would you tell me?
Providing value and concepts and strategies for myself and for our listeners and Joe and other people. Providing, things I'm passionate about, finding value in those things and being able to then create that content for other groups to consume.
All right. And why is it important for you to provide valuable content for your listeners? Why is that important?
Well, these are the things I'm passionate about. So I love the study of and the discussion centered around team development and leadership and things like that. And those stories, I like getting those stories out from a variety of books and discussions, and then being able to have those available for people to consume. So there's more content out there and more ideas and strategies for people to consider as they lead their teams and communities.
Great. Okay, so when I asked you the question why, what I was looking for, are you telling me that it's important to you because you're going to achieve something, or because you're going to solve a problem or prevent something? Hmm. Like you might say, you could have said, well, if I don't provide valuable content, then there's really no point in my having this podcast, right? Mm-hmm. And so that would be that you were moving away from something, that you're wanting to prevent something. But what you gave me is an answer that is really goal-oriented. These are the things you wanted to achieve and the value you wanted to get out for people. Mm-hmm. So all of us take action either to achieve a goal or prevent, solve, or avoid a problem. And those are opposite languages. So if I'm talking about goals and you're talking to me about the problems you see, we start to disconnect and vice versa.
Okay? Now say that last sentence again. You and I would you and I physically, you know, in our discussions and connecting with one another would start to disconnect because you are more of achieving something and I'm more of these are problems.
Yeah, looking at the problem with it or trying to avoid something. Right? You've been in meetings where someone will start talking and they think this is the greatest idea that ever came down the pike.
Right.
Right. And some other people are sitting there and saying, yeah, they haven't thought about that really, or they wouldn't be saying that. You know, what about this? What about this? What about this? Mm-hmm. And so if they raise it in that way, what begins to happen in the room?
Yeah, if that comes up, I mean, you have me thinking because this is really good already. I mean, we're just, I really appreciate this already. Yeah, this is going to be an amazing class.
Definitely put us on the spot here. And I think, too, honestly, I would have answered a little bit different than George, even though we have talked about what he has said. And I don't know if this makes me any difference, but, you know, for me, and George and I have talked about this as well, is just this is kind of our way of giving back, right? Giving back to the community. Mm-hmm. Ideally, if we're helping a handful of people, then great. If we're making people better off, if people are learning and we're educating people, like, then we've met our goal. So I think that's kind of, I guess, an additional. So I don't know if now does that put me in a different bracket than George? Okay, I was just curious.
Same bracket, and did you hear yourself say goal?
Yeah. Right. Yeah, but and then to your point, your question, and if I didn't hear your question correctly, correct me. But the person that comes up with an idea to achieve something or is goal-oriented, hey, what if we did this or how's about this? And then you have three or four people grumbling about all the problems with that. That, like, I'm very much a believer in energy. I just, and not necessarily like a real big goofy sense, but I believe you give energy to a group or you take energy away, right? And if we can get everybody kind of bringing energy to a group and a team and a company and a department, then we can problem solve and move the needle forward. So to your question, if there's two or three people that are grumbling and finding problems in something I might be suggesting, man, I think that's just a huge energy drain on other people. Or maybe I'm not going to have any other great ideas, or maybe, you know, I'm not going to bring that stuff up further if I know that all my ideas might get torn apart, or and maybe I just have to be tougher to be able to accept that feedback and criticism.
Well, see, all of those things go on if we don't understand what's going on. See, these people think not that their energy sucks, but they're on the same team and they're helping you because they're pointing out things that could really go wrong. Mm-hmm. And so they're saying, so why are you, you know, and people say this, like, you're not a team player. Well, I may be, and that can shut down the person that's about to tell you where you're going to go off a cliff or something you ought to pay attention to. Now, the issue is, how do you get on people's plane? So if I know, I think, okay, they've got problems with this. So I've got to talk to them in the language of problems. I might say to them, so are you asking me, how would I solve the problem of giving the one? And then they might say, yeah, how would you do that? Mm-hmm. Right. Or if they want to get a hearing and they know you're just really gung-ho on this, and they know the minute they start using problem language, you know, you're going to disconnect. And often we make negative attributions about people who are in a different place than we are, right? And so they're thinking, all right, if I want to be effective and get a hearing, then I might say, well, George, if you want to, I see where you're going with this. And if you want to achieve this, a question that comes up in my mind is this. Mm-hmm. So I have stayed with you in goal language and towards that, but I have been able to raise an issue in a way that's less offensive to you because it's still going to goals.
Do you think that's a language that people would want to have that is not like, I don't think, and I could be wrong. You're the PhD, right? I'm a ball coach, right? And so when we sit back, is that something that people need to be aware of in that whom they're speaking to and how they would receive that language? Or do you think it's an art of, this is just how I need to talk in terms of the group and encouraging the group? Like, it's okay to say, hey, that's a great idea, George. But here are four or five things that are top of mind that are kind of, that could be risks for us, right? There's a language to that, right? I wonder, do you need to make it specific to the person with the idea or just in general, like to the group? So
in both, and in general, you first want to match language. So you are not, in a sense, disempowering the person. You're not in some way making them feel less and breaking the connection. right? Mm. And so this is something for people to know. When someone's in goal mode, you speak goal language to get there to and then raise your issue. If they're in problem mode, you first have to touch base with problems, or they don't trust you because you like don't get that there's a real problem here. Mm. Okay. And see, the thing is, we shift from time to time. There are going to be times. And so that's the other thing. This isn't a personality type, right? This is just in this context right now, I'm more interested in the goal I'm going to achieve. Mm. If I buy AAA insurance, am I buying it to achieve a goal or prevent a problem? I don't want to wind up, you know, and not have access to someone who'll come and give me a tow, right? So there are different products that we may buy one way or the other. We need both sides, but the issue is most of the time, if people don't know what we call influencing language, how you connect with the other person so you can have a conversation, then these things can go haywire. And people can start making negative attributions about each other's personality and their motivations and so forth, simply because we're in this context filtering for something different. Mm. Shelley Charvet, who's the person who trained me 20 years ago and popularized this, has this great line. She says, if you want someone to go somewhere with you, you have to meet them where they are and not pretend that they're already there. Okay. If you want them to get on the bus, go pick them up at their bus stop.
Hmm. Yeah, I really like that a lot. Yeah.
And yeah. So this is just one dimension of bus stop. Another one that comes up all the time for leaders and managers is one we call options versus procedures. Hmm. And you can ask, the way you can get at this is by asking the question, why are you choosing this? Or why did you choose your last job? Okay. And some people, when I ask that, will say, well, I chose it because it was more money. It was advancement. It looked like I'd be working with really cool people and so forth. Right. Mm-hmm. But someone else might say, how did I choose it? Well, you know, I had gotten to the point where I'd been doing this job for a long time. And one day I was looking at the ads and the postings in the company. And all of a sudden I saw this posting and I thought, you know what? I think I'll go apply for that. And I had my interview and I was selected and here I am. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the people that give me a list of reasons why, I know that in that context, they want a lot of options. Okay. They're looking for a whole lot of options. But the people who tell me a story, they're ones who, in this context, want to follow a procedure and have a procedure that they can count on that they know will get them to the end. Hmm. So when leaders are taught to delegate by just telling everybody, just give me the outcome that here's the outcome I want. All right, just get it any way you want. Options, people who have options running the options pattern in that context love that, right? Woohoo! And if you get to break the rules, it's even better. But people who are more procedural are saying, oh dear, he went to that class. How long? Mm-hmm. Would you just give me an idea of how you want it done? Mm. And now you can coach people like that, but you have to coach them in sort of step by step. Say, all right, well, what do you think you'd do as what do you think your first step would be? Oh, they can hear that. Or, you know, the meetings where you have someone say, does anybody have any ideas about this? And you get crickets.
Right.
Absolute crickets. All right. Well, there can be a lot of reasons for that, but one can be if you're dealing with people who themselves and their jobs are largely procedural, you've just given them an options question. Any ideas?
That's a great point. Yeah, I'm in the software world, which is intrinsic by nature, right? People very, like to sit in their cubicle and write code. And I've posed those questions before. And then I let there be silence until it becomes uncomfortable. And finally, somebody will say something. But that is interesting, right? That, maybe IT people are just very procedural, right? But now we've opened up this open-ended question for some dialogue. And maybe that's why we get it.
Well, and see, what you can do then is if that's the, and you kind of know this in advance, say, here's what I'd like you to do. I'd like you to, first of all, to think for a minute. What's something you've noticed in the last week that to you seemed like, you know, really an inefficient way of doing it? And then I'd like you to write it down. And then think about also what you thought we might be able to do instead. And write that down. Now, I'm going to go around the room and I'm going to ask each of you what your ideas are. See, you've given them a process to open up ideas. Hmm. But absent the process, they like can't work with it. Right?
Right.
And yeah. Again, it's, and you know, there are some times when we want a lot of options. And sometimes we want, so take IT. So I'm pretty primitive with this, and I've had to, you know, learn. I've learned step by step. But if I have someone helping me who's a real ace at this, and I say, you know, how can you help me to get something on favorites? And they say, well, you can go here and do it this way, but then you can also do it this way, Ellen, or you could do it this way. At this point, I'm just going nuts. Right. I'm saying, stop, please stop. Would you tell me one way and tell me the steps, and I'd like to write them down. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I can get to that. Later on, I might want options, but often when people learn something new, they want procedures. If you go to a bank or if you've got an institution that you're working with, most of us are procedural. We want to know what are the steps we have. I got my COVID shot this morning, right? Nah. If you've ever, my second, if you've ever seen anything that was procedural, and it was like clockwork, right? And so I was happy, very happy to have them, you know, have a procedure for me. So often when we're dealing with institutions or certain things, we like having a procedure. But the minute we have a customer service problem or things don't go the right way, we do not want to hear from someone, well, now this is our procedure. It'll makes people furious. No, I want you to fix it any way you can for me right now.
Yeah.
So in customer service, people can go this way. So I'm going kind of on and on.
No. There was one thing though I really want us to hit on. And we still have 25 or so minutes. When we were when we were talking offline, this happened to me this week, and this will lead into the question that I have, and kind of this checklist I think that you kind of gave us offline. They're part of our process in our IT isn't as streamlined and lean and efficient as it probably should be. So we noticed that this past week. And then I ended up having a meeting with one of our senior people, and he continued to tell us about the problem, right? That just continued to tell me. And I kind of took it because this guy is just so talented, so skilled, so important to what we do. I was like, well, you know, this could not go well. But he ended up telling me five things maybe that aren't going well. And, you know, when you hear the word, the way we're doing things is not sustainable, things like that. I was like, oh geez, this is going to be interesting. Right. But what I appreciated from him, really appreciated, was he came to me with some solutions, right? He didn't just come to me and tell me like, hey, here's five things that really stink and we're not going to be able to meet this deadline deliverable, et cetera. And things are not going well. Have at it, George. Like, but he laid it all out. But then he came to me with solutions to the problem. And that sprung in my mind a little bit as you were talking offline before we recorded, because you started talking about problem solving styles and that there were a number of different styles that people might have when it comes time to actually, you know, it's, you know, I don't know if this is the right way to think about things. It's okay to gripe and moan and complain and say things aren't great or that we're not as good as we could be. I'm actually absolutely fine with that with my teams. I'm not fine with it if we don't have solutions and things that we can change and get better and get the right feedback. And this gentleman did this morning, but you had a number of different problem solving styles and I wasn't quick enough to write them all down. And would you mind sharing some of those with us so we could get those kind of down and some notes about those styles?
Absolutely. But first I might say when the people that do come to you with just problems, and again, they're in problem mode. Yep. One of the things we recommend in innovation is to help them shift that and say, oh, so are you saying, how might we do this? And so every time you get in a regular statement or a problem, help them convert it into how might we. And all of a sudden, the brain begins to go into solution mode.
Okay. Yeah, before you go and answer that, and sorry to interrupt you, you do an amazing job to acknowledge you for this. Like, you do an amazing job, and that's why you're so successful at what you do, is this idea of shifting language and the word choices. You know, it's this idea, and Joe and I have talked about this in the past, of like simple things like I have to do this as opposed to I get to do this, right? Just subtleties in the phrases you use of somebody coming to you with problems and then you pivoting that in to them and say, how might we help? Like, that's a phrase I wrote down right as you were saying it, because our word choices to inspire, to create momentum, to solve problems is so important. And it's an art. It's something you really got to spend time studying and thinking about, and what works and what doesn't. So things like that, like, that's a takeaway for me, like, no question.
We call that the language of innovation, is how might we.
All right.
Mm-hmm. But to the four styles that you were talking about, if you think about problem solving, the first thing you've got to do is understand what the problems are out there, right? And so there are some, and what are some things we really ought to be working on? Mm. And there's some people who are really good at being out in the environment. And they come across stuff. They talk to people. They find out what folks are doing. They look at things. And they'll get ideas. And they'll bring them back to you. And they'll say, hey, do you know what they're doing over there? We really ought to think about that. What about that? And then they give you some data. But then they're kind of done. Like, somebody else ought to do something about that, right? Mm-hmm. But they've got a million of them, because they'll go talk to some more people. And they'll got a bunch of them. And then there are the people who can listen to the data you bring in, that other person brings in, and they're the dot connectors. They're saying, okay, now wait a minute, if we put that together with that, so he's just saying somebody, you know, and if we think about our capability, you know what, for us, that could look like this. So they're the ones that pull the, you know, connect the dots, and we call them conceptualizers. They're the ones who want to figure out what's the underlying concept, or what's the why, if we're going to do something. And once they've got the concept, they can often generate ideas, but they're more intellectual, where the other people are much more out in the environment touching things. These are more kind of intellectual people. Mm-hmm. And they'll come up with a bunch of ideas about what they've thought of as the issue, but then not all the ideas are good ones. And so we need then, at that point where we've conceptualized an idea, now we need to optimize it. We need to figure out what's the best idea of all of these. And sometimes we need criteria for that. Like, you know, is it within the budget? Do we have people with the competency for it? Is it really kind of new, so it'll excite people? So, you know, we develop criteria and then we judge the ideas by that. Optimizers are really good at that, but they want one idea to really work well. And then they can plan it. They're really good at how we would go forward with that. All right. So they got the plan, but you still got to do something, right? And so the last phase of the cycle is, how do we sell it to people? That's the idea. Mm-hmm. And then how do we implement it? And that's the role of the implementer. And these are the people, and they just love to take action. And so when other people are talking about the why and the going, it's working their last nerve. They just want to go do it. They're the just do it people. And their genius, their creative genius, is figuring it out in the moment. That's their creative superpower. They'll adjust and they'll make it work and so forth. The superpower of the conceptualizer is really the connecting the dots for ideas. But because one is think and one is do, these two people, if they don't know their place in the cycle, they can conflict. You know, and not know why. Like, what does that person do? Why do they even pay them? They just sit around thinking. You know, there are those of us who get out and do things. And then the generators sometimes can have people drive the optimizers crazy. Wait a minute. You're like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. And could you give me just one of these and let's work over one of these? Don't bring me any more right now. Thank you. Mm. You know. And so that can be some attention that can go on. If it works well, everybody kind of plays their role and we begin to appreciate what people are bringing. The other thing that can happen, though, is if on our team, And you know, I work a fair amount in financial services and construction, and there are certain styles that go with the occupation. So if you get a whole lot of implementers and a whole lot of optimizers, they tend to take what is and then go out and work it. Mm-hmm. But they might not bring in innovation. They might not bring in the new ideas, and eventually they can get behind. Now, if you get in some places where you might, like in a marketing firm or, you know, I don't know where in IT the real idea people live, where they sit, but you get those folks together, and a good meeting to them is when we've come up with a ton of ideas and one is built off the other. But then they're kind of done. You know, they don't want to necessarily take it forward, and they don't want to have to choose because there were so many good ideas, right? Mm-hmm. So these other people are ruin the party. And so what can happen with this, with organizations or teams that are largely generators and conceptualizers, is you can get a whole lot of ideas, but you never get something out the door. You never get a product out the door. And so it really takes all of those styles to be able to do this. Now, so that can kind of, you can even look at it from an industry perspective and say, what's that like? Or from a team perspective. And, you know, I think leaders really need, if innovation is key for companies to get ahead, I think leaders, and particularly high-level leaders, have to, what I say, mind the quadrants. Where are the new ideas coming in? Who are the people who are thinking with us about what would be a really good thing to do? You know, who are the people who can help us do what's really reasonable to do? And who are the people that we can trust to go out there and just make it happen?
So also, Alan, I want to circle back on just to make sure too that I'm following along. Now that you've given your four areas, so what I heard was conceptualize or optimize. You got to sell it and you got to implement it, right? So George's boss came with a problem and some potential solutions. So then you kind of gave maybe some feedback on some different wording. So I guess, you know, now that I've understand your four areas a little bit better, did George's boss handle that in the correct way? I mean, if a guy like George's boss is coming with potential solutions, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Or did he stifle the ideas of other people? Because now when you have a most senior person giving ideas, did he ruin it for, you know, the people that are on George's teams that are maybe these, you know, conceptualizers that maybe have better ideas? I'm curious on what your take on that is.
I think that's really insightful, Joe, because particularly when you have that power dynamic, mm-hmm. then there is, whether they intended or not, and it doesn't have anything to do with sure. with intending it, you people start to process potential threat.
Right.
Once you get threat, people will shut down because they'll go into caution mode. Mm-hmm. All right. And so the more leaders can be catalysts for the ideas and maybe bring theirs to the end, and because they may have, it's not that they shouldn't bring theirs, but how they can pull those out of folks in a variety of ways. And when I do these engagements with people and we try and generate a whole bunch of how might we statements, the key too is when it looks like people have kind of petered out, just say, I bet there's more here. And you know, some of the really insightful things will come out after you've kind of forced the issue a little bit rather than stop. Because it's easy to stop when somebody says something that sounds really great and the implementers are like, okay, that thing, we'll go do it. Mm-hmm. And it might not be the best idea. So I think that's a really important thing, Joe, for leaders is how do they make it happen and not squelch it?
Yeah, I think a lot of times leaders.
Go ahead, Joe.
Well, I was going to say, I think a lot of times leaders think they need to be the smartest person in the room. And when, in my opinion, they need to ask the most effective question, right? Mm-hmm. So how to, you know, because I think there's a lot of, let's call it whatever it is. I mean, in my opinion, there's a lot of egos, right? Especially the higher the level you go. And they want their ideas to be heard, which in my opinion is not always the best. I don't know how you kind of coach or your thoughts on that, like how does some leaders maybe satisfy their ego but ask the right question?
That's a good question. Yeah.
Well, you know, what I get leaders to think about, mm-hmm. is I asked them the question, what's your real job here?
Yeah.
What's the most effective thing that you can make happen here?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. It's a great question. I don't know if that's hyperbole of you just saying, but if you really roll into places of leader with leaders and ask that question, what kind of answers do you get to that question? That's interesting.
Well, you can get a variety of, when I'm coaching them, generally they're stopping to think, but often they're the answer people or mm-hmm. the ones that'll function for you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was coaching a leader in a government organization, and it was sort of an operational role, and she was really high up in the organization. But because she knew so well how to do things and could get them done faster, she did not hold some of her supervisors accountable for things. And after a while in the coaching session, she said to me, you know, some days I just feel like a babysitter. And I said, so what's it like to be a babysitter? How's that working for you? You know, and her boss would do things like that. So I said, is it like everybody sort of dumps things and you're the babysitter and you've got to take care of all of it? What's it like? And so she really kind of got into it and thought about it. And I said, so if you weren't the babysitter and you were doing these other things, who would you be? And she said, well, I'd be my real job. I'd be the deputy chief. And I said, and so if you were really the deputy chief, how would you be dealing with these situations? Well, I'd be going to my supervisors and I would be saying, you know, how do you go? And then if they needed some help, I would help them and so forth. But the identity we carry around when we're in a situation makes certain things possible or impossible because of how we're thinking about ourselves. And sometimes when you give people direction, this is how you ought to do it. All right. Mm-hmm. If they have their old identity, they might try it and do it, but it's not sustainable because they're still at this other level that hasn't shifted yet. Right. Mm-hmm. And so the mindset has to shift for the behavior to make sense and to be sustainable.
Yeah. You have a PhD in what, Ellen?
It's originally in clinical psychology.
And what is, I'm going to ask a naive question. I have an idea of this. I don't know the exact, what is psychology? Give us that textbook definition of psychology, clinical psychology.
Well, clinical psychology is the understanding of personality and of functional and dysfunctional behavior. And
perfect.
The goal is to help people move from dysfunctional things that don't make their life, that make their life not work well, strategies that will help them understand maybe at a deeper level where something comes from in one form of psychology, or help them with, you know, the thinking errors they're making in another. So their psychologists work in different ways. They have different approaches, but that's what
and,
I would say.
You know, yeah, no, I asked that question for a purpose. Because your background and your PhD in clinical psychology really has served you in this role, or maybe it opened the door to this. So you're of leadership and understanding how the mind works and how people work and how to get somebody from dysfunction to function, a dysfunctional team with 30 people to a functional, high level, elite performing team of 30 people. And what is involved in that, and learning about language and how word choices affect people and bring people down, and how to move people in mindset. Like that is like, you've got that PhD in that field that most people don't have. Right. So, I mean, you are well-trained and educated, for that exact purpose of building teams, getting them from dysfunction to function, and building individuals within the team and understanding what those dysfunctions are.
Mm-hmm. And when it's a true dysfunction, or whether it's a communication issue that now is beginning to present like a dysfunction, right? Because people will tell you stories. I gave a talk on this in January to our International Coach Federation group here in St. Louis. And you know how often people, when they have conflicts with people, will say, well, you know, they're boomers and they don't get the younger generation. Or, you know, I think he's got an issue with women. or I think she's got an issue with men, or And so we find these ways to sort of explain to ourselves what's going on. And I posed the question and I said, what if the real issue is that we're just talking opposite languages? And it's as simple as that, but we're polarized because you think there's something wrong with you that you're seeing it this way. And because you aren't where I am, you're probably really trying to kind of get me, or you're trying to discredit me in some way or something like that. And so for me, what's fascinating is what is the most efficient, if you will, way to understand what's going on between people? And is it styles, you know, problem solving styles? Is it pathology? And, you know, this goes way, way deep. Is it that they just don't know how to talk someone through something in a, you know, talk through a conflict in a way that they have a strategy for it? Or is it, you know, a language disconnect? So for me, it's always kind of what's going on here, and and how can we help? How can we give them a vision of what could be different?
So Ellen, I mean, I can only remember taking 3 hours of psychology in school. I took a management class. My master's degree, we had another management class. Never truly understood the importance of psychology. And as I've gotten older, especially as I've had kids, and the fact that I have managed people that have been with a company more years than I had been alive, you know, just that whole entire age gap and the way you need to talk to people. I didn't know about all this stuff. You know, I wish my 20-year-old self had, I mean, to me, a psychology degree is probably more important than understanding, you know, people and understanding race and age, you know, gaps between, you know, managing a 20-year-old and managing somebody 65, and how you communicate to women, how you communicate to men, you know, understanding all these, that you have people on your groups that are in potentially one of the 4 different phases, as you talked about, from problem solving. Like, you need to go to that person for this and this person for, you know, here's the sell up person, here's the implementer person. I mean, I guess my question really is what do you recommend to people? Like, how do you close the gap? I mean, most people are not going to go get a PhD, which we all should have one in psychology. And I wish I did. but what is kind of the recommended? I don't know if it's books.
If people want an introduction to what I've been talking about with regard to the language, I'd recommend they pick up a book called Words That Change Minds.
Okay.
Mastering the Language of Influence. And that gives you kind of an introduction to this. But there, you know, there are people like me that give courses in this, you know, group coaching. And it goes into sales as well as management as well. They're all the same patterns. Once you learn like toward a goal or away from a problem, and you learn that you need to kind of connect, touch base with somebody, it fits in every aspect of your life in every, you know, and it, so it's important in sales too. People buy things, for example, for 2 reasons. And there's 2 patterns for which people buy something. They buy something either because for some kind of change, they want some change to happen, and they want some different impact than they're currently having from getting this solution. And so if you want to know what that is, it's we ask the question, if you compare where you are right now with this, with where you'd like to be in 6 months, how would you compare that? And some people will tell you, well, I'd like it be pretty much the same. Actually, I don't want to lose any more clients. You know, so that's what we would call sameness. Somebody else might say, well, I'd like to be a little better at this. Or I'd like to have a nicer car, one that really has more horsepower or something. Well, that's what we call progress. And then someone else would say, you know what, I've got to completely rethink this. And that's what we call change. Okay. And so you want to know what's the level of change that they want from this, so you can connect with them. And then impact is, and so what impact would you like this to have? And some people will say, well, I want to better ROI. I want to up my revenues by X percent. I want to have better systems in place and so forth. But other people might say, in addition to that, it's not like they would say one or the other. They mm-hmm. might say, you know, I want my people to feel more energized. I want my kids to see me at night. I need to be more efficient. I want, and so is the impact you want on what we call thing or person, right? And so that, you know, just asking those open-ended questions and listening for what you're listening for can help you understand at a deeper level, as opposed to a surface level, what someone wants in that relationship.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to make sure that we're, you know, honor your time, because I know you have a hard stop at the bottom mm-hmm. of the hour here. And we usually wrap up with this. I've got a page full of notes here and everything is underlined. I'm going through it. Right. So, and I really appreciate what I was thinking halfway through this was, we need another 45 minutes with you. I'm reading a book right now. Called The Attributes. It's by Rich DeVinny, who's a former Navy SEAL who goes through 25 attributes that we all have in us that kind of are things that challenge, stress, and uncertainty. We'll reveal these, but just kind of where we're at. One of the attributes, which I've found interesting and actually enjoy him listening to his podcasts where he talks about this, is narcissism. That you wouldn't think that's an attribute for leadership and teams and things of that nature. But and when you look at the book and read through this paragraph, this chapter, he talks about, you know, narcissism is making it all about you, right? And I bring that up for this reason. One, we're really big into celebrating here. And I want you to go from probably zero on the narcissism scale to 10. Make this all about you, Ellen. This is your whole deal. This is all about you. Be very narcissistic. What is the one thing in your professional career that you did, that you're proud of, that you accomplished, that when you sit back, you say, I did that, or I contributed to that, that you sit back and say, man, that was really special. That was a really special time, and I was a part of it, or I did it.
Yeah, a couple of things come to mind. One is going over and being asked with 30-year-old German to work with a group of German executives and teach a program. And just because I spoke pretty good conversational German, they set me up to go over and work with these scientists along with a Swiss counterpart. And I thought, how in the world did I oversell myself into this?
That's great.
And so I thought, okay, I've got to get through it. Mm-hmm. And so I went in, and when we were talking, I said to the folks, I said, look, it's not you by now have noticed that I make mistakes in German, right? Mm-hmm. So what I'd like you to do is these little papers you have, the little round ones, if you hear me say something that's really, really egregious, would you write it down so I'll have that as the correction? And do that. The other thing that I did was I found the best English speaker of the scientists, and I had him dictate to me in German what I wanted on my flip charts.
Hmm.
And so with that, at the end, and I had this Swiss partner, at the end, they gave us both a bottle of wine and said how wonderful this was. And it was... And it wasn't because I was spectacular at it. I was like good enough to get through.
Great. What a great lesson. Yeah. Just to interject on that. This is what I hear you saying. You went decent enough German, 30 scientists or whatever, and you have to give a presentation. And one of the first things you do is to immediately solicit feedback from them. Hey, I'm not that great at this, but you're going to get my best and I want to get better. And I'm here to get better. I'm here to provide value. I'm here to give you some content. I'm here to give you a perspective on this subject, but do this for me. What can I do to be better? Right. That's very, very humbling. And for you to do that, very vulnerable, I guess is the better word. Very vulnerable for you to say, hey, I know you hired me to do X, but this is what I need from you. And I'm not good at this. How can I get better? That's really, that's a great, I acknowledge that. That's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you said you might have two things. What was the other thing that you would celebrate?
Well, this was a group of executives in a manufacturing company, and it was a new product development team. And they were not working well together, and it was taking too long to get the product out the door because each function that was represented was concerned about their own function not being disadvantaged. Mm. And so there really wasn't that level of cooperation. So I got this methodology was developed at P&G and is still used there. And I have a colleague from there. And the two of us came in and we went through this methodology with them. And by the end, you could see everybody was having a beer together. It was just, you could see the collaboration because the process took them through it in a way that they could begin to appreciate each other. And so they took out some stages that they didn't even use, but they were put in because people didn't do the right thing. So we're going to correct it and add something here. And what I had to do too was also in the beginning, I had interviewed all of them and I realized they had poor conversational ways with themselves. And so I took them through what something we call conversational intelligence and talked about the three levels of conversation. And so they could use that as a framework and that the highest level was this collaborative solve it together. Mm. And so that was really great and we got a lot done. And then they asked us back the next time. And it was really interesting because when I did the interviews, because we had cleared out so much of the stuff at the lower level, that was all of the questions that they were, or the issues they brought up were more strategic. And that time we were able to really engage them in a dialogue with their leadership. And it was really fun because the person who hired me said, well, we're calling this culture of collaboration. And he said, now tell me, give me enough of this. What do I have to do next? He said, we're going to go try and get the production guys in on this because they're not really part of our culture of collaboration. And they really were on the mission themselves to create that culture. And they wanted to keep it away from HR because they wanted it to be the operating people that were doing it. And so it was really interesting to see that by the end of this, in a couple of years, they were talking proudly about the culture of collaboration that they had created. Mm-hmm.
Doing this. Yeah. Well, I really appreciate both those stories. Mm-hmm. You know, the first one, my takeaway is that vulnerability of wanting to get better, but also, again, this book I'm reading right now is really impacting me significantly, but this idea of challenge, stress, and uncertainty, but this also this idea of fear, right? And fear and anxiety, anxiety and kind of stress kind of lead into this fear. But one of the ideas of this is to have some courage. So it took a lot of courage on your part to go into this new environment where you don't know German maybe as well as you need to, but you're also going to be presenting, and to your point that you felt like you weren't really qualified for that, but you were courageous enough to do it and then humble enough and vulnerable enough to ask for help that you can do it better. And then your other story, I take it as exactly what you said earlier, to take in people or teams from dysfunction to functional and this culture of collaboration. I love that. I wrote that down, this culture of collaboration. I've been with organizations that kind of hang their hat on the culture of feedback and knowing what that is, what that looks like, and how to give it, how to receive it. But I really like this idea of culture of collaboration as well, because it goes right along with what we started with, this leadership dialogues, and why the dialogue is so important in that. Ellen, what is the best way for people to track you down? I can make sure to put your website in our show notes. Are there other ways people can get in touch with you to learn more?
Yeah, they could just reach me through Ellen at Leadership Dialogues, and Dialogues is dialogues.com. Right. And my business phone is 314-995-6825.
Perfect. Perfect. And I'll make sure to have that information in the show notes, and really appreciate, you know, that 48 minutes and 44 seconds that we've been together. I mean, that's mm-hmm. really good. We need to do another one of these because the one thing you gave us a second episode teaser by saying the three levels of conversation and you didn't really give them to us. So I'm sitting there going, well, we got to know what those are. So maybe we'll have another episode where we can go over some of that. I really appreciate your time, Joe.
Yeah, thanks a lot,
always, Ellen. Always good to be with you, Joe. And everybody, go ahead, Ellen. I'm sorry.
I just said that. Thank you. It's been great fun chatting with you.
Yeah, thank you very much. And everybody, have a great rest of your week. And thanks for listening to Out from the Cube. Thank you.